stifling after a romp with a stranger. But usually, she lied. Now she watched Hammond look quickly at Ani, who was absolutely stone-faced, and then back at her. He smiled.
"Really?" he said, his tone almost light. "How could that question possibly incriminate you?"
She said nothing.
"So the last time you ever saw Alex Sokolov was as he was leaving the airplane, after you touched down in the Emirates?"
he pressed. "On my counsel's advice, I am taking the Fifth." Hammond said to Ani,
"I'm not sure what you think we're looking for here, Ms. Maradian, or why in the world you would give Ms. Bowden that advice."
Ani glanced down at her nails and then up at Hammond. Her legs were crossed, and her skirt had ridden up a few inches on her thighs. Her pantyhose were black and sheer, and Cassie recognized the color as one of the shades the airline approved with the uniform.
"What are you looking for, Agent Hammond?" she asked him.
"We're just trying to learn all we can about the death of an American citizen in Dubai. We're trying to see what he did there the night before he was killed. A courtesy for another country. A courtesy for a grieving American family in this one. Maybe Alex Sokolov said something to your client that will help us find out who murdered him."
"Why not ask her that?" He nodded.
"Okay."
Then he turned back to Cassie.
"Did Alex Sokolov say anything to you that might help us find out who murdered him?"
"No," Cassie answered.
"That wasn't so difficult, was it?"
Ani asked the agent. He ignored her.
"Did Sokolov tell you where he was going when he landed?"
Ani jumped in.
"Agent Hammond, surely you have already asked Unisphere Asset Management that question, and they have told you. For the life of me, I can't see why you keep coming back to this line of questioning with my client. I'm sure you know exactly who Alex Sokolov was meeting with in Dubai. I'm sure you know exactly why he was in the city."
"And do you know, Miss Maradian?"
"No. Do you care to tell us?"
He looked irked, but he said nothing to the lawyer. Instead, he turned back to Cassie and said,
"Let's make it easier. Did he tell you the name of the hotel where he was staying?"
Ani jumped in again.
"We all know that, Agent Hammond. It's been in the newspapers, for God's sake."
"Ah, but did he tell your client? That's my question."
"I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment not to answer." Cassie noticed that Washburn was writing even that down.
"Do you honestly believe that we or the police in Dubai think you've done something wrong, Ms. Bowden?"
He was, Cassie supposed, trying to sound at once astonished and hurt. She might have believed that he actually felt that way if Ani hadn't warned her.
"I'm guessing that's a rhetorical question," Ani said to the case agent.
"It's not. I'm trying to help solve a crime. I'm trying to help a family get justice. And, just maybe, I'm trying to save other lives by catching a killer."
"All noble goals. I want you to succeed," said Ani.
"And there are flight attendants, passengers, and an air marshal on Alex Sokolov's last flight who are quite clear about this. Your client was talking to him. A lot. And in their extensive conversations, it is at least remotely possible that he may have told Ms. Bowden something that could be useful."
"So you don't believe she has done anything wrong?"
Cassie was struck by how everyone was suddenly referring to her in the third person, as if she weren't there. She, Ms. Bowden. She wanted to raise her hand and remind them that she was here. She wasn't invisible. She recalled a line from an old Beatles song. "I know what it's like to be dead." Hammond's brow grew furrowed.
"Why would we? Because she went to Unisphere's New York office late yesterday afternoon?"
And then, as if it were only a game of high-stakes poker, no one said anything. She could see that Ani and Hammond were trying to surmise each other's tell, that almost imperceptible behavioral tick that would allow them to gauge their opponent's hand and sense their advantage.
It was actually Washburn, the scribe, who broke the silence.
I just want to confirm, he began quietly, looking at Cassie. You said Sokolov didn't tell you at which hotel he was staying, correct? You only learned where he was staying from the newspapers, well after the fact.
Then he put his head back down and seemed to be staring at the tip of his ballpoint pen as he held it an inch or so above the yellow paper with the thin blue lines.
I took the fifth, she said, the words timorous and momentarily caught in her throat. She clasped her fingers together in her lap, because otherwise they would be visibly shaking.
Where were you the night that Alex Sokolov was murdered?
Hammond asked. I am taking the fifth.
Were you in your room that the airline had booked for you at the Fairmont Hotel? In other words, were you at the same place as the rest of the crew, or did you spend the night elsewhere?
Again, I am taking the fifth.
You know the fifth is not some crazy magical bullet, don't you?
Hammond told her. She said nothing. She tried to breathe slowly. She tried not to think about the drink she would have when she got out of here, but to focus instead on this poker game, this chess match. Did they somehow know, and know categorically, that she had not been in the room the airline had provided her? Or were they just presuming she was not there because of the Royal Phoenician security camera photos?
No, said Ani, answering for her. It's not, but it is her constitutional right.
And I hope you realize, Hammond went on, that by invoking the fifth, you are only giving me the impression that you really have done something incriminating, that you really do have something to hide.
Cassie stopped. She didn't know what she wanted to say.
Look, Hammond began, his voice growing a little more gentle. Let's just clear up the little things, the easy things.
Okay, she said.
When did you meet Alex Sokolov?
For a moment, the absurdity of the question confused her, and she had to think about it a second.
On the plane, she said, when he boarded.
You never saw him in New York?
No.
It's a weirdly small city, and of course you did go by his office yesterday.
She remained silent.
Anyone tell you he was going to be on the flight?
He asked.
No. Why would someone? That's...
That's what?
That's not how it works. No one tells us who's on the flight until we get the passenger list before takeoff.
The FBI agent looked at her earnestly.
I'm trying to help you, Ms. Bowden, but I can't help you if you don't help me.
I think she's being quite helpful, said Ani. He ignored the lawyer and continued.
The newspapers. I'm sure you've seen them. Is that you in the pictures, Ms. Bowden?
What newspapers? What pictures? She asked.
She was stalling, and the two FBI agents had to know it. How could she not have seen the newspapers by now? But her reflex, when she couldn't answer with a grandiose lie, was to answer with a modest one. Hammond was clearly going to play along.
Well, let me tell you. Some of the newspapers have published security camera photos from the hotel where Alex Sokolov's body was found. Most have published two. One shows a woman on Sokolov's arm the night before he was killed. The other shows that same woman leaving the hotel the next morning. Alone. She's wearing the same clothes.
Washburn opened a manila folder beside his pad and placed the two photos on the table in front of Cassie.
Here they are, he said.
Ani smiled, but didn't glance at the pictures.
A walk of shame? Seriously, why are we even discussing this?
Hammond ignored her and elaborated.
The legal attaché in the Emirates says that the woman in these pictures matches the description of the woman, an American, who three different hotel employees say they saw with Sokolov the night before he was murdered. Apparently, she matches the woman with whom he dined at a French restaurant that evening.
The photos were 8x10s, They were crisper than the reproductions in the newspaper or the images she had seen on her phone, but certainly not crystal clear. Was the woman indisputably her? Not indisputably. The first was a grainy, long-range profile. In the second, the woman was wearing sunglasses. In both, she was wearing the scarf. But a reasonable person could reasonably suppose it was her.
"Recognize the scarf?"
Hammond was asking. She shrugged. She gazed for a moment at the arabesque, at the almost hypnotic array of tendrils and swirls.
"One of the flight attendants on the plane with you from Paris to Dubai recalls you buying one just like that when you landed,"
Hammond said.
"It was near the duty-free shop at the airport. Maybe even next to it."
She wondered, was this Megan? Jada? Shane? It could have been any of them. Or someone else. There were 9 other flight attendants. "I may have," she answered simply.
"So, is that you?"
She looked up at him, and she looked at Ani. She glanced at Washburn. She held her hands tightly together, but she couldn't stop her legs from shaking under the table. She knew she was supposed to take the 5th. But suddenly, she knew also that she wasn't going to. She knew it. She thought once again of that old Beatles lyric, "I know what it's like to be dead," and understood with certainty that she was going to lie, because that was who she was. And you can no more escape your DNA than you can an Airbus that is pinwheeling into the ocean after... pick one, she thought to herself. Just pick one. A cataclysmic mechanical failure, a suicidal pilot, or a bomb in the cargo hold. She was the lightning that brings down the plane. The pilot who panics on the final approach in the blizzard. They'd probably found her lipstick in Alex's hotel suite already. Or perhaps that lip balm. They'd found it where she had left it, or where it had fallen out of her purse. They'd found it beside a mirror in the bedroom, or the bathroom, or on the carpet near the chair where she had tossed her purse. They'd found the incontrovertible evidence that she had been with Alex the night he was killed.
"Well?"
Hammond pressed. Ani was mouthing the 3 syllables, "Take the 5th," her eyes wide and intense. Instead, however, Cassie gazed for one long, last moment at the images on the table, savoring these final seconds before the plane hits the earth, unsure whether the next few words would result in a successful crash landing or the aircraft would break apart and explode upon impact. She took a deep breath through her nose, exhaled, and then said, "Of course it's me. Alex and I met on the plane, we had dinner in Dubai, and then we went back to his hotel room. We made love in the bedroom and in the bathroom, in the shower. And in the morning when I left, he was still very, very much alive. I can assure you of that. He kissed me once on the forehead before I said goodbye, and then said he was about to get up himself. But I swear to you on my life, when I left the hotel, he was perfectly, totally fine."
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD-302, Extract. Cassandra Bowden, Flight Attendant. Date, August 3, 2018. Although Bowden had pled the 5th multiple times in the interview, including one time when asked if Sokolov had told her the name of the hotel where he was staying, when shown the hotel security camera photos, she admitted that she was the woman in both of them. She said that she and Sokolov had dined at La Petite Ferme before returning to his hotel room at the Royal Phoenician Hotel. There they had consensual intercourse 2 times before going to sleep. She says that when she left his room on the morning of July 27th, he was alive. He was awake and kissed her. She acknowledged leaving about 10:45 a.m. She didn't believe he had any meetings that day until lunchtime, which was why he had suggested she shower and get dressed first while he lolled in bed a few more minutes. He had even joked, "After all, you have a plane to catch. I don't." Finally, she said that a woman came to Sokolov's hotel suite the night before. Sokolov introduced her as Miranda, last name unknown. She seemed to be American, roughly 30 years old, brown eyes, auburn hair, medium height for a woman. No eyeglasses. Baggy black slacks, red and black tunic top. The woman brought a bottle of vodka with her, and the three of them shared it. At the time, Bowden thought Miranda had something to do with Unisphere Asset Management. She presumed she was either an employee or she had money invested in a fund. Bowden insisted that she visited Unisphere on August 2nd, hoping to learn more about the woman or about Sokolov. Bowden thought that Miranda may also have been involved with real estate in Dubai. She said she had a sense that Miranda was going to be in the same meeting or meetings as Sokolov the next day. She did not believe that Sokolov and Miranda were close friends or had known each other very long. It was even possible that they were meeting for the first time that evening. Bowden believes that Miranda probably stayed less than an hour, but she was intoxicated by then and unsure. She recalled they talked a little about her work as a flight attendant. Sokolov and Miranda were interested, but not their own work. The conversation was difficult for Bowden to recall in any detail because she was drinking. Follow-up. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, has informed us that Alex Sokolov's computer showed 7 Russian investors in the Unisphere Stalwarts Fund who had been singled out by OFAC, including Viktor Olenin. Withdrawal and transfer records suggest Sokolov's theft from the fund may have exceeded $2 million. ODNI said that there were 2 emails with Russian operatives we believe were affiliated with the Syrian chemical weapons program, one of whom is believed to be a Cossack. But the content was routine business about the fund's returns. There were no specific mentions of sarin, VX, or the compounds at the Bluegrass Army Depot in Kentucky in the emails, nor was there any reference to chemical weapons defense tools. There was no reference to the stealth drone or jet drone projects. But there was information on the flash drive that seems to have come from the Edgewood Chemical Biological Center, though we cannot yet rule out a source at Bluegrass. Finally, there were no emails or documents or references anywhere on the computer to the flight attendant.
Chapter 15. Elena really wasn't afraid that the passenger in the lavatory was a terrorist. He was a Sikh in an orange turban. He had to have been close to 70. But this was a U.S. carrier flying from Dubai to Amsterdam, and a fellow with a beard and a cloth on his head had been in the bathroom nearly 10 minutes now. The Americans on board were starting to fret. "I am really not going to be happy until that guy gets the heck out of there," she heard one woman saying. A man joked to the passenger beside him. "Yeah, it's a long drive, but right now we're at 35,000 feet and I kind of wish I'd rented a car." Even the flight attendants, a pair of middle-aged guys who were still pretty buff and clearly knew what they were doing, were conferring. Elena was in the bulkhead seat in coach, which was about as good as it got in that cabin, and so she could see and hear the business-class passengers trying to encourage the flight attendants to do something, but parsing their words to dial down their racism and paranoia. "I'm sure he would come out if he knew he was inconveniencing people," said a mother Elena speculated was a decade older than she was and had a son 7 or 8 years old sitting beside her. "It's probably just all that Middle Eastern food," said the gentleman across the aisle. She guessed he was the woman's husband, given the way that he had reached over and patted her arm. Even the casually dressed dude, who Elena was sure was an air marshal, had grown sufficiently alarmed that he had unbuckled and was leaning into the aisle, staring, poised to assist the flight attendants if it came to that. But Elena suspected it wouldn't. Terrorists weren't 70-year-old Sikhs. Finally, when she counted 5 people clogging the front of the cabin, one of the flight attendants knocked on the door and asked the fellow inside if he was all right. When he didn't immediately respond, she watched the heads pop over the wider, cushier seats in business. Some of those passengers very likely were imagining the explosion that would take out a part of the portside fuselage and the flight deck, sending them all plummeting to their deaths somewhere over Hungary or Romania. The flight attendant began knocking a little more determinedly, but his voice was still cool. The last thing he wanted was to overreact. It made her wonder what Cassandra Bowden would do. Had she ever been in a situation like this? No doubt she had. The woman clearly had a fight-or-flight mechanism that was either uncannily precise or badly off-kilter. If Elena had to choose, she would bet on the latter. A broken magnet. A shattered gyroscope. It was just then that the Sikh emerged, and he looked a little irate that his personal space had been, in his opinion, seriously violated. The air marshal sat back, and one of the flight attendants said to the passengers and first who were watching, "He had something disagreeable for breakfast." The Sikh glared back at him and took his seat. Elena recalled what Victor had said about Cassandra Bowden. "She's a drunk and a little self-destructive." When her father had formed the Cossacks a quarter century ago, choosing the most patriotic, translation old-school Russian, officers he knew in the KGB, Victor had been about her age right now. It was Yeltsin who'd seen the iconic power in Cossack culture and first allowed for the rehabilitation of one of the Bolshevik Party's fiercest opponents during the early days of the revolution. Now the Cossacks were among the darkest arms in the FSB, the successor to the KGB. They worked often with Russian military intelligence, the GRU, as they were on this project. And yes, they were among the most corrupt. Elena knew that. Her father had known that. And clearly the Americans knew it. The Cossacks were ruthless. And they were rich. Victor was smart. He'd probably moved all of his money from Sokolov's fund already. They all had. It had probably disappeared before she had even been dispatched to room 511 at the Royal Phoenician. Oh, the investigators would try and follow the money, but eventually they'd hit a wall, an impenetrable coral reef somewhere in the Caribbean. They might find Sokolov's. She'd left plenty of breadcrumbs on his computer, but not Victor's. Elena had a pretty good idea what would happen to her if she didn't kill the flight attendant. Victor had been eminently clear. But she knew there would also be violent aftershocks even if she did take care of this loose end. She guessed it depended on what, if anything, Sokolov had told Bowden and what the woman remembered, what she was telling everyone. But Elena would never forget the rage she'd felt when she finally understood what the Cossacks had done to her father. Methyl iodide. For years she had thought it was a stroke. Elena tried to analyze precisely what it was that she herself didn't know, which was a lot. It was all a bit like the wooden nesting doll she'd had as a child. The figure sat on her dresser, first in Moscow but then in Sochi. A smiling peasant in a colorful sarafan. She would separate the top from the bottom, and inside there was a smaller doll, a smaller figure. And inside that doll was a third, more petite peasant still. Altogether, there were four dolls nestled inside Matryona, the tiniest one, the only one that wasn't hollow. She sighed. Victor would have someone looking over her shoulder in America. She was positive. Now she gazed down at the in-flight magazine that was open on her lap. Her eyes rested on a photograph of Sylvia Plath, and an idea came to her. Bowden's death shouldn't look like an accident. It should look like a suicide. This way, everyone on both sides of the Atlantic would have plausible deniability. She should wait for the newspapers and the news channels to out the flight attendant as a drunk and a murderer who wouldn't, at least right away, be extradited to face trial. Then, publicly shamed, Cassandra Bowden would kill herself.
Part 3. Act Like a Grown-Up. Chapter 16. Ani waited to rip into Cassie until they were outside Federal Plaza and walking west toward Church Street, where they could find a cab heading north. "What's the plan, Cassie? To go to prison here or in Dubai? What in the name of God were you thinking?" She was walking so quickly that Cassie was almost jogging to keep up, and she was doing it in high heels. "It just seemed
easier, Cassie said. Can we get a drink and talk about this?
We can talk about it in my office, not in the cab.
I could really use a drink.
You could really use some common sense.
It almost doesn't matter if you are innocent. Every single thing you've done has suggested you're guilty. You fled the scene. You told no one you were in his hotel room. You lied by omission when you landed.
Not really. No one asked me anything.
Okay, fine. You lied by commission just now.
I know. I get it. It's just...
Arnie stopped and turned to face her. Her eyes were wide with rage.
It's just what?
She asked, her tone accusatory.
It's just that it was so clearly me and the photographs. It's just that they probably have my lipstick already, and now it doesn't matter because I've admitted I was there.
So what? You take the fifth. Besides, it isn't clearly you.
It's likely you.
Big difference. Very big difference. And your damn lipstick could be anywhere.
Do you know what's going to happen now?
Cassie shook her head. She waited.
They are going to confirm the approximate time of death with the coroner in Dubai. They won't know the definitive time, but if they can show it was before 10:45 in the morning, you are fucked.
Pardon my French, Cassie, but you are fucked. Then they stood in silence for a moment, and Cassie thought she might get sick right there on the street. She looked down at the sidewalk and took a few slow, deep breaths to compose herself. Maybe she was self-destructing because she knew on some level that she had in fact killed him, and she was craving punishment. Justice. Across the street was a bar with a neon sign with a four-leaf clover.
Please, she said, her voice quavering as she pointed at it. I've got to have a drink. I really, really do. In a voice that was quiet but intense, a fioritura of frustration and fury only barely mollified by the gin and tonic she was finishing in great gulps, Ani explained to Cassie what she believed was likely to happen next, all of it contingent only on the time it would take for three people to connect as midnight neared on the Arabian Peninsula. The FBI's legal attaché in the United Emirates, his connection at the Dubai police, and the coroner in that massive city by the sea. Last week, Ani said, after Alex Sokolov was found, the medical examiner had autopsied the body. He, and in Dubai, Ani supposed, it was more likely a male than a female coroner, had seen how much, if any, of the veal from dinner remained in Alex Sokolov's stomach, taken the body's temperature, and checked to see how far rigor mortis had progressed.
I don't know a hell of a lot about forensic entomology, but I can also see them examining the bugs that are starting to eat at the guy's corpse. There probably weren't beetles, and there certainly weren't maggots yet, but there may have been houseflies, Ani said. In any case, the coroner will have offered an approximate time of death. Cassie had downed a shot of tequila as soon as they arrived, and the warmth had helped. It was pretty good tequila. Smooth. She was calmer now, at least a little bit. The tequila reminded her of Buckley and dancing barefoot in the bar, a memory that was growing sweeter and fuzzier with time. She was almost done with the margarita she had ordered immediately upon finishing the shot.
You said it would be an approximate time of death. That means there's a window. Do you know how big that window is? Are we talking an hour, 3 hours, five maybe? She asked.
She sat back in her stool and swiveled so she was facing Ani. Sometimes she really enjoyed a place like this. Dark paneling and little light. Not quite a dive, but a far cry from Bemelman's at the Carlisle. There was a pair of older men in drab brown suits at the far end of the bar, but they were the only other customers here this time of the afternoon.
Probably in the neighborhood of 2 or 3, Ani replied. But decomposition isn't really in my wheelhouse. It could be more, it could be less.
They found the body late in the afternoon, right?
Yes.
A notion was floating just beyond Cassie's reach. She thought she might be able to reel it in if she could talk the idea through. So let's say Alex was found at 5 p.m. You and I know he was killed before I woke up, and that was around 9:45 in the morning. If the window is 3 hours, let's hope he was killed an hour or so before I first opened my eyes.
Don't get your hopes up. By 8:45 in the morning, there were people in the hallways. Housekeeping. Guests checking out. Guests going to breakfast. No one commits a murder in a hotel room if they have to run a gauntlet of guests and maids.
There was no one around when I left the room about 10:45. And even if there were people in the hallways earlier in the day, doesn't that help my case? People coming and going? A crowd? Maybe whoever did it counted on the crowds.
Ani folded her arms across her chest.
I said there would be people. I didn't say there would be crowds. I seriously doubt that the fifth floor of the Royal Phoenician is ever Penn Station. Still, all we need is the window to work in our favor.
And to be big. Really big. Think picture window big, Cassie.
She nodded hopefully. And they're going to try and find Miranda now, right?
Yes, they will.
Cassie was disturbed by the cadence of Ani's words. You make it sound like there's a but coming.
There is. We already know there's no woman named Miranda who worked with Sokolov. There's no Miranda at Unisphere Asset Management.
So?
What if there's no Miranda anywhere in his life?
Look, I didn't make her up. I'll admit, Alex barely knew her, if at all. I told you, maybe she's just a friend or relative of an investor.
The bartender glanced at the two of them, and Ani grew alert.
Cassie understood that her lawyer wanted her to lower her voice. Another round? He asked the two of them.
No, thank you, Ani told him, and Cassie felt a pang of disappointment.
Then her lawyer took a deep breath and said to her,
You drink too much. You pass out. You black out. And you are, by your own admission, a liar. You lie all the time.
The words hung in the air, revealing and hurtful.
I thought you believed me, Cassie murmured.
She could hear the devastation, almost childlike in her response. It was as if Annie had betrayed her.
You're not even sure you believe you, Ani said quietly.
Sometimes, she shot back. Most of the time I am absolutely confident. I did not kill him.
Fine, said Ani. Fine. If it makes you feel any better, I don't think you did either.
Does that help or make a difference?
Not at all.
Let's hope there is evidence in the hotel room that this Miranda person exists.
There will be.
Won't her DNA be there?
It's a hotel room. There's DNA from 100, 1,000 guests in there.
Of course, she agreed. But then an idea came to her. Her DNA might be on the glass she used. So might her fingerprints. I wiped the glasses down, but who knows how thorough I was. I was kind of panicking.
Aside from the reality that wiping down a couple of glasses just screams guilt, how do they compare the DNA to a person they can't even find? How do they compare the fingerprints?
It's not like there's a database of DNA and fingerprints of people who say their name is Miranda.
I see.
I just don't know what you were thinking when you volunteered the information to the FBI that you slept with the guy and spent the night in his suite. I am just incredulous. Either I wasn't thinking, or I was thinking they already knew from the photos that I had spent the night with Alex, and they were going to find my DNA or my fingerprints or my stupid lipstick in the room somewhere. I honestly don't know which.
You are making the assumption that you're even going to allow them to swab your cheek to get your DNA, or take your fingerprints. I will still try and stall that for a very long time, but you have made my job that much more difficult.
I'm sorry. I really am. Ani's face went a little pensive.
You said the day we met that the cuts on your hands were from a broken glass. Were they?
Yes,
What are you suggesting? Do you think I tried to kill myself?
No, of course not. They were on your hands, not your wrists. I was thinking defense wounds. You were trying to protect yourself. You were fighting off a knife or that broken bottle. Tell me honestly. Did Sokolov attack you at some point that night? Maybe, forgive me, I have to ask, some sort of creepy sex play that got out of hand? He never attacked me, Ani, at least that I can recall. But that doesn't sound like him. He was... Go on. He was really good in bed. It was our first time, and he was pretty gentle. Those cuts on my hands? I saw a Dubai news article with the two security camera photos of me, and I dropped the wine glass I was holding. It was in my bathroom the night before we met. You even drink in the bathroom? I had brought a glass of wine with me into the tub. Not the worst thing I do, Cassie said. Okay, so the cuts had nothing to do with an attack, said Ani. I get it. You told me about Sokolov's neck. Did he have any defense wounds on his hands or his arms, as if he were trying to parry the broken bottle? You mean if I were attacking him? Or someone? There was blood everywhere, but I don't think so. There was absolutely no evidence of a struggle? If there was a struggle, don't you think I would have remembered it? The lawyer replied by raising a single eyebrow. No, said Cassie. You're right. I wouldn't have remembered. But I don't think there was a struggle. I don't recall seeing any cuts on his hands or his arms. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's not a good thing. I wish I'd thought to have photographs taken on Monday morning of the cuts on your hands. That's on me. That's my bad. If they do decide you killed him, it would have been nice to claim there was a fight and you were desperately defending yourself. Cassie looked at her hands. She hadn't even bothered with band-aids today. The cuts no longer looked like very much. I guess it's too late now. Nevertheless, Ani took out her phone and used the camera to take a series of pictures, posing Cassie's fingers and hands on a white paper placemat on the bar. These are probably worthless since the wounds are 5 days old and I'm using a camera phone, but what the hell, the lawyer said. By the time I find a photographer on a Friday afternoon in August, the cuts will be completely healed. There is one good thing about Alex not having any defense wounds, Cassie said. Go on. Maybe it means that he didn't feel any pain. I've been hoping he just never woke up. That's sweet, but not helpful. I know. Remind me, Ani asked, what time did you pass out? It was a blackout. It seems like I was still up and about, functioning. Sort of. I wish I had just passed out. Okay. What is the very last thing you remember? Cassie put her face in her hands and thought. Her fingers were moist from the perspiration on her glass. Finally, she looked up and answered. Here's the chronology. Miranda is there, and I'm dressed, and we're drinking. We're in the suite's living room. She says she's going to leave, and I'm going to leave with her. But you didn't leave with her, right? Ani interrupted. You were there when Alex broke the vodka bottle. That's correct. He convinced me to stay, which wasn't that hard. We drank some more, and we had sex again, this time in the bedroom, but then I got dressed. You're positive? No, but almost positive. I'm pretty sure. I really did plan to return to the airline's hotel. That was my intention, anyway. Miranda had left, and now I was going to leave, too. Do you know what time Miranda said goodnight? Perhaps they could find her on the security camera. 11? 11:30? Midnight? That helps. So you would have left when? Cassie shrugged. 12:30? 1? An hour later, I guess. Okay. But they didn't see me at that time.
Or at least they didn't publish any photos from the lobby security cameras of me leaving in the middle of the night. That would suggest I didn't leave until the morning. Or at least that you didn't get as far as the lobby.
Yes, she said,
and an idea, fuzzy and inchoate, began to form. She tried to gather it in, to mold it, to imagine where else she might have gone. She focused on the corridor. She saw so many hotel corridors, but few as elegant as the one at the Royal Phoenician. There were the long, endless hallways, which was typical, but the oriental carpets had been beautiful, and the elevator doors, when you got there, were black and gold. There had been the sconces along the walls, at once Aladdin-like and futuristic, as if the genie had instead been a Martian, and there had been the exquisite guest room doors, with their Moorish cross-hatching bordering the panels. There were the divans, with the ornate blue and gold upholstery by the elevators, and by the windows, and in the nooks at the corners. She had stood beside one when she first exited onto Alex's floor with the key he had given her at dinner, enjoying the view out the window on the way to his room. No, it had been beyond his room. She had walked to the end of the corridor to see the city from there. "Sometimes I make a wrong turn when I leave a hotel room, even when I'm sober," Cassie said. "I am just in so many hotels. We all make that mistake. Pilots, flight attendants. The elevator was to the left and around the corner in Berlin, for instance. But then it's to the right and straight ahead in Istanbul. It happens all the time." "And?" "I don't know. This might sound pathetic, but I have a vague memory of panicking in the hallway after leaving his room." "Because someone was after you?" Ani asked, clearly a little stunned.
"No, because I was lost. It was the middle of the night, and I couldn't find the elevator, and I couldn't find his room. I couldn't even remember his room number. I mean, now 511 is branded into my brain, but it wasn't then. Think of all the room numbers I see every month of my life. Anyway, I didn't know what to do. I think..."
"You think what?"
"I think I collapsed on a divan in one of the corners of the corridor. I think it was by a window that overlooked the city."
"This was after Miranda left."
"Yes, this was after she left. And so there I was, alone in the corridor. But I was so drunk, so very, very drunk. Maybe I got lost and gave up. Maybe I just sat down on the thing and tried to figure out what the hell to do. And maybe there I passed out. In other words, I never made it to the lobby. I got lost in the hallway and crashed on the couch for, I don't know, half an hour, maybe less, maybe more. But I woke up before anyone from hotel security or room service happened down the hallway."
"And then you found your way back to his room?"
"That's right. I had a key. Maybe the catnap helped me to focus. Or sobered me up just enough that his room number came back to me."
"You wouldn't have to have been gone all that long. I'm guessing even 10 minutes would have been enough for someone else to enter his room and kill him."
"Oh, it's very possible I was gone at least 10 minutes. Those hotel couches and divans looked really, really comfortable."
"And when you return, the room is dark?"
"At least the bedroom is," she answered. "Maybe there was a light on in the living room." She had to believe that even she wasn't ever so drunk that she would knowingly crawl into bed with a corpse. Still, the reality of what she was suggesting was beginning to become clear.
"God, Cassie, what if Alex was killed at 1 or 2 in the morning? That's why you take the 5th.
Ani's frustration was evident as she paused to take another long, last swallow of her drink.
"I wish I knew more about how precise an autopsy could be at pinpointing a time of death."
"Aren't you glad I told them about Miranda? At least now they have a suspect other than me." The lawyer stared at her, but said nothing.
"Look, I'm sorry," Cassie said. "I am. I'm just built... weird."
Irresponsible would be a more precise word. So would insane. Will we know what happens before I fly to Rome? Ani put both of her hands on Cassie's knees. You are assuming that the next time I see you isn't after you've been arrested. At, let's see, a bail hearing. You are assuming that you haven't turned over your passport by then. You are assuming you still have a job. Cassie picked up her margarita and ran her tongue along the very last of the salt on the rim. The glass was otherwise empty. I'm taking my niece and nephew to the zoo tomorrow, she said, her voice a little numb in her ears. It was as if she had headphones on. Then, will I be fired? The zoo. Your job? Really? Are you hearing a word I'm saying? She nodded. I am. The union will have your back. My uncle will have your back. Call him tonight and let him know what's going on. I'll call him too. I rather doubt the airline can fire you. Presumption of innocence and all. But at some point they may put you on a leave of absence. There is a whole branch of law that studies precisely when you can fire an employee for off-duty conduct, and when you can't. I see. I'm not sure you do. I'm really not. You know what's the damnedest thing? Right now, after you decided to just drop by Unisphere yesterday afternoon? After your performance with the FBI today? That's one hell of a high bar. I don't know. Tell me. It's this. That expression you just used. Presumption of innocence. Who knows what I'm capable of when I'm that blotto and the memory's collateral damage. But I really do know in my heart that I didn't kill Alex. I do stupid things when I'm drunk, and I do irresponsible things, but I don't do that. I don't cut people's throats. And so if a hammer comes down hard on me this time, it will be a kind of awful irony. Cassie. She waited. The waves of Ani's anger were receding now, and in their wake was only sadness and worry. I promise you, you've done nothing so bad that you deserve what might be coming. Cassandra, Troy-born daughter of King Priam and Queen Hecuba, knew the future, and no one believed her. At least, most of the time, that was what occurred. Apollo gave her the great gift of prophecy because he was confident that she was going to sleep with him. When in the end she refused, the god spat in her mouth, leaving behind the curse that no one would ever believe a word that she said. And so she lived with frustration and dread. Cassandra, Kentucky-born daughter of no one who would ever be construed for royalty, pondered the disbelief that she, too, left in her wake, and the apprehension and fear that now marked her every step. The reality of what she had done, and what she had not done, had become incontestable fact in her mind, but she rather doubted the FBI ever would believe it if she were to volunteer the chronological truth. She said goodnight to Alex Sokolov and left the palatial digs that existed behind the door to room 511, sometime around 12:30 or 1 in the morning, and then wandered the hallways in search of an elevator. He was most definitely still alive at that point, but she never made it to the elevator. She just never found it. And so she collapsed, an appalling, drunken, boneless marionette on an ornate Middle Eastern divan, and dozed. When she awoke, she still didn't reach the elevator, either because once more she couldn't find it, or because she hadn't even remembered that it had been her original destination. Either way, she returned to Alex's suite, stripped naked, and climbed into his bed, utterly oblivious to the fact that he was dead. Or almost dead. No. In the morning she had seen his neck. He had bled out quickly. He was dead. And she had slept the rest of the night beside his corpse, in the same sheets,
her head on the pillow beside his pillow, his blood clinging to her hair. This was a spectacular, revolting fail even by her standards for indignity and mortification. She guessed if she weren't already such a lush, the revelation would have driven her to drink. And yet, for whatever the reason, despite her performance at the FBI office that afternoon, the authorities did not come for her that night. She and Ani shared a cab uptown, Cassie exiting on 27th Street, and she was back in her apartment by 5:45. She called Derek Mays, Ani's uncle at the union, and he actually seemed considerably less shocked by the story she shared, beginning with the body in the bed and building to her confessing to the FBI that she had spent the night with Sokolov, than she might have expected. She attributed this more to his rather low expectations of her as a person than to his experience with flight attendants generally. He assured her that he and Ani would talk, and together they would look out for her. He was comforting. He reminded her that she hadn't definitely killed anyone, though he did add, a dig that was more ominous than funny, "At least that's your story this week." And then, buoyed by Mays's generally can-do attitude and the Washington State Riesling she opened and poured over ice, she called Buckley. Didn't even text him. The actor suggested they meet for a drink later that evening, after he'd seen a friend's show at the Barrow. And since it was rare for her ever to say no to a drink, she said yes. They picked a bar in the West Village this time, one near the theater. Then she collapsed onto her couch and stared up at the Empire State Building. She pulled the paperback Tolstoy from her purse and sipped her wine and read, hoping to lose herself in the narrative and escape the reality of her life, and yet somehow also to glean insights into Alex Sokolov's. It was an impossible balancing act. If she was reading to learn more about the man who had died on the sheets on which they'd made love, then certainly she wasn't reading to take her mind off the utter precariousness of her future. Before returning to Happy Ever After, she paused on one particular paragraph about Ivan Ilyich that had stayed with her. He had an affair with a lady who threw herself at the elegant young lawyer. But the relationship meant nothing to him. It all came under the heading of the French saying, "Il faut que la jeunesse se passe." Translation? Youth must have its fling. It made her feel old. She reminded herself that she had viewed Alex as but a harmless romp, too. Eventually, she phoned her sister, who was already at her hotel in Westchester, and they picked a time to meet tomorrow morning at the zoo. They'd rendezvous at 10:30 at the fountain near the sea lions, just inside the Fordham Road entrance. She was grateful that she wasn't going to be alone with the kids. She was actually relieved. It would be such a disaster if she were alone with her nephew and niece when she was arrested. Buckley took her hand as they walked from the bar to his apartment. It was only a few minutes after midnight, and so the West Village was still vital and vibrant, the narrow streets crowded, the bistro tables along the sidewalks full.
"You are checking your phone a lot," he murmured.
She had told him nothing, nothing at all. Either he hadn't seen the photos in the newspapers that day, or he had looked at them so quickly that the fact they were her hadn't registered. "I haven't been reserving years, but the airline asked me to be available," she lied.
"Didn't you say that you're flying to Rome on Sunday night?"
"They might want me for another route tomorrow instead." The air was cool, and she wished that she had brought more than a sleeveless blouse. She felt the hair on her arms rising.
"Would you still get to go to the zoo tomorrow? I'd hate to see you miss the sea lions and your family."
"We'll see," she said, though in her mind she imagined herself replying, "If I'm not at the zoo, it's probably because, best case, I'm meeting my lawyer and getting my cheek swabbed for DNA. Worst case, I'm being arrested for murder." But she didn't say any of that. "Tell me more about your audition," she said. Tell me more about the pilot. You said it's a drama.
Sort of. Based on the script, there's also a lot of very dark humor. It's about a Staten Island drug family. Apparently, there will be a lot of scenes on the ferry and a lot of nighttime shooting. And shooting during the shooting. It looks crazy violent. I'd be one of the brothers. Think Edmund and King Lear. I'd be the younger brother and a bastard. Literally and figuratively.
Do you think you have a chance?
Yes, but only because it's a small role. It's a recurring character, but not one of the four major leads.
He pointed at a squirrel clinging to a second-story screen window and peering into the apartment.
Peeping Tom, he murmured.
Looking up at the squirrel from the sidewalk was a huge orange tomcat, his fur so thick that Cassie could see only a bit of the collar. His tail was thwapping back and forth, sweeping the concrete. She thought about her cats at the shelter, and so many of them were her cats in her mind, at least until they found permanent homes, and wondered what they would do without her. Oh, there were other volunteers, but she didn't know how diligent they were about sneaking in catnip and treats and toys, and rushing the poor things for hours and hours on end. When will you know? She asked.
If I got the part? Next week, I guess.
Then,
there's lots of great sibling stuff in the script, too. That's the kind of material that fuels my jets. My relationship with my brother and sister in real life is pretty complicated.
Yeah, mine too.
Are you and your sister close?
Not really.
You wouldn't be friends if you weren't related?
Probably not.
Even after all you two endured together growing up?
Even after that. He asked her what her sister did for a living, and then what her brother-in-law did. He found her brother-in-law's work far more interesting. Everyone did. No one asked follow-up questions when you said your sister was an accountant. But an engineer at an army base that disposed of poison gas and nerve agents? People were fascinated, especially men.
I'll bet he doesn't talk about it much, he said.
Because it's all so classified? She asked.
Because it's all just so dark. Chemical weapons? That's crazy. We've all seen the pictures from Syria.
I think he's in charge of getting rid of them. Or one of the people in charge anyway, but yes, it is classified.
And not exactly Thanksgiving dinner table conversation, in any case.
Nope. Then, feeling uncharacteristically defensive of her family, she continued. He's really not a dark person at all. He's pretty chill. He's very sweet. I get along better with him than I do with Rosemary.
Well, you and Rosemary have a lot more history together.
Yeah, we do. And most of it's kind of dark, she said. She asked him to tell her about his family, and he laughed a little bit. But then he started to talk, making jokes about Westport and wasps and how his family's Thanksgivings would have rivaled Martha Stewart's when it came to detail and production values. She leaned into him as he regaled her with tales of the crested blazers he would wear as a boy and his mother's impeccable Christmas trees. She was tipsy, and she liked herself best when she was tipsy. She thought she was prettiest when she was just on the cusp of drunk. She'd spied herself, or studied herself, in enough mirrors, at parties, on airplanes, in her compact, to know that her eyes looked a little more wanton and her lips a little more inviting when she was just starting to leave the sadness of sobriety behind. When she was working, when she'd snuck a drink or two on the flight, she knew that men watched her differently, their own eyes more rapacious. She could feel their gaze on her hips, her ass, as she worked her way up and down the thin aisle. And so she stopped walking, which led Buckley to stop. She had to take her mind off this kind man's childhood, and the shelter cats, and the travel, and the liquor. All that she might be about to lose. She felt no one was following her now. No one. He stared at her for a long moment, regarding her.
"What is it?"
he asked. "It's you," she said. "It's a starry night in the city." Then, for reasons that she didn't precisely understand,